מקודשת on air
broadcasting from Philbet on the Jerusalem seam line
particular one that you played in Armenia this must have been like a year and a half ago about like lost love like those two lovers
yeah did I do that song in Armenia I played it oh Sarere Ovi Merne to die for the mountain breeze
something like that
I usually have a theory that Armenians are the originators of long distance relationships because in every folk song in Armenian folk songs there is a boy there is a girl and a mountain in between and for some reason they just don't want to walk around it they just you know stare at it and I'm like that is the obstacle in my life
that's right
I will never be able to it's better overcome.
Actually, not to actually see the girl
exactly
she's a big disappointment usually
you know we're actually you know we're recording so this is in it whatever we're talking about right now Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Apo in the Apo and the City once again. Today I'm with Matthew Friedman. Is it Friedman or Friedman?
Friedman.
Friedman. Matthew, you introduce yourself because you're a man of many talents.
I'm glad that you think that. It's completely untrue, but I'm a journalist, I guess. I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada. Came to Israel when I was 17. That was 25 years ago. And I've been a daily journalist, been a freelance journalist. I've written a few books about different aspects of the Israeli experience.
Good books.
Well, I couldn't possibly say that.
I've read two of them, right? Pumping Flower and Spies of No Country, right?
That's right. And there's a third one called the Aleppo Codex, which is a true story, but it's a mystery about the most important copy of the Bible. One of my kind of consistent interests over the years as a resident of Jerusalem has been the city that I live in, and that's where we've found some common interests over the past couple of years and some very interesting conversations about this place.
Although most of our conversations, I guess most of our conversations would have to do with your third book, which I think your third book touches on themes that most of our conversations have touched upon, which is the minorities in the Middle East and how the demographics sort of shape where this region is going, where it's not going, and all of that, which brings me to the question that I would want to open up this conversation with. You have a, let's say you have theoretical patterns that you deal, that you approach Jerusalem with. One is to follow the trash trail of Jerusalem. The second one is Talpiot, the industrial zone in Jerusalem. Just take me through those theories. What is Jerusalem to you according to these theories?
Sure. Well, in Judaism, there is this idea that there's a Jerusalem of the heavens and a Jerusalem of the earth.
Like
the imaginary Jerusalem and the real Jerusalem. And I think that similar ideas exist in perceptions of Jerusalem outside of religion. So I was a news reporter for many years. I worked for the AP, the Associated Press, which is the big American news agency. And when you cover Jerusalem as a foreign reporter, then you have these stories about Jerusalem. It's Arabs and Jews and Israelis and Palestinians and the one Armenian. And the three Armenians, Apo and his parents. And, you know, the Temple Mount and peace and can it be divided and can it not be divided? And that's the frame through which journalists tend to view the city. It's a very kind of narrow political frame. And as a journalist, I always just kind of thought about the city in that way and wrote about the city in that way. And over the years, as I lived here for longer and longer, I moved to Jerusalem in 2000 for my first year of university. And I've been here ever since. So it's been, you know, more than two decades now. And I realized over time that the stories we tell about Jerusalem don't actually explain the city. So we have these very powerful stories about Jerusalem, whether they're political stories or religious stories, but they don't explain the day-to-day life of the city. We have this incredibly complicated place, about 900,000 people split into three very different groups who, you know, have completely different ideas about
what. The three would be secular Jews, the Haredi Jew or religious Jews, and Arabs.
Right. It would be ultra-Orthodox Jews who are really distinct in their approach to the state of Israel. And they kind of have they're made up of many different groups, of course, but they have a kind of a unified approach to things, the ultra-Orthodox. Then you have the Palestinians, who are mostly Muslim with a smaller Christian minority. And then you have what we would call, I guess, in general terms, secular Jews, but most of the Jews in that group in Jerusalem aren't actually secular. They're traditional or religious, but they're Zionists. So they're kind of affiliated with the state of Israel. Those are the three main population groups. And of course, there are other smaller groups in the city.
Yeah. Me and my parents.
Most importantly, the Armenians. But those are the three big groups. And those groups agree on very little, or would seem to agree on very little. And you'd expect Jerusalem to be an absolute basket case, kind of like Aleppo, you know, and a decade ago, Aleppo, which is a city not far away from here, in Syria just falls apart. It just, you know, collapses into civil war. Something similar happens to Baghdad and other kind of multi-ethnic or, you know, multi-religious metropolises around this area. They don't survive, and things can get very, very grisly pretty quick. And yet Jerusalem somehow functions at a remarkably high level relative to what you might expect. And this is, you know, partly a question of whether you see the glass half full or the glass half empty. But
it is a question that, you sure you're not seeing it through a romantic way?
No, I'm definitely not.
Are you sure you're not forcing this view, that you want to believe that this exists?
No, I think that, you know, over years as a journalist, you learn that the glass half empty view is the acceptable one and the glass half full one is not acceptable. So the dark view is necessarily more accurate than the, you know, than the light view. And the truth is that they go together. Therefore, there are many dark processes in Jerusalem. But if you ignore what sticks the city together, you can't understand it. So there's so many people talking about the negative processes in Jerusalem that I do think it's important for at least one person to point out why the city functions as it does. And a good way of looking at that, we can get into trash and the industrial zone in a moment if you want, but a good way to think about it is just looking at the statistics of the city, homicide statistics, which is something that I look at the end of every year. So if you look at an American city the same size as Jerusalem, if you take Indianapolis, for example, that's a city that happens to be almost exactly the same size as Jerusalem, about 900,000 people. Last year in Indianapolis, the homicide number was 215. So 215 people are murdered in Indianapolis last year. That's, you know, an American city. It's not insane. There are worse cities in America per capita. There are places like New Orleans and Chicago, which are kind of notorious for homicides. So Indianapolis is a, you know, one American example. If you look at Jerusalem, which is, again, this kind of powder keg of a city, you'd expect it to be incredibly violent, and it's covered as if it were a violent place. It's covered as a city of conflict by a contingent of international reporters, which is probably bigger than any other contingent in any other city in the world per capita, maybe with Washington, D.C. being an exception. So it's covered as a city of conflict. But if you look at every single fatality in the city last year, 2020, for any reason, so you take conflict-related deaths, you take, you know, domestic homicide, criminal homicide, everything, any person,
across the board,
you know, anyone,
across the three groups,
anyone within the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem, the number last year was 10. We had 10 violent fatalities.
So boundaries, those include the refugee Shafat refugee camp.
Anything that's inside the municipal boundary of Jerusalem is counted in that number. Again,
and that's 10.
As far as I can tell. Yeah, no one will actually give you that number. The police will never give you that number. So you have to look at news reports and human rights reports at the end of the year and try to figure it out. I might be off by one or two. But the number is about 10, which is 1/20 of the rate of violence in Indianapolis, which is a city where no one thinks there's a war. So Jerusalem, compared to an American city, is actually a remarkably safe place. And we don't think of it that way. And international observers generally don't think of it that way. But that is really true. And the question then is, why? Why is Jerusalem so so nonviolent when you could expect it to be, you know?
But someone could tell you that it is institutionally violent, right? Could a Palestinian not make that argument that, sure, you're not seeing hundreds of people dead on the street, but it's institutionally violent. You know, you have 30% or more of the city facing, that's what they would say, right? They're facing a bureaucracy that is violent towards them, right? Every night there are arrests across East Jerusalem. There is police presence, a heavy police presence across it. Yesterday, somebody died in a Haredi neighborhood, right? The van, I don't know what happened with the van, right? And so the Haredi would say, yeah, the police are also being very forceful towards us. I'm pretty sure in America, blacks would say the same thing, right? So my question would be, do you take that into consideration that maybe it's institutionally more violent? Because we consider and say, sure, there are 10 deaths and good on us, but it doesn't mean there isn't tension. And that tension is always, I mean, Jerusalem has always been a powder keg, right? That we're always feeling like we're stepping on a powder keg, that it's going to explode any minute now.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything that you said, that there's tension in the city, there's deep inequality built into the way the city operates, right? A third of our residents aren't citizens, and it's tied into this very complicated conflict, which has many moving parts. So it's a deeply unequal city. There's a real political inequality in the city, which is that, you know, the Palestinian residents of Jerusalem aren't citizens of Israel. So they can theoretically vote in the municipal elections, but they don't because they don't want to recognize Israeli rule of the city. And you have deep political inequality, which also ends up affecting economic inequality. If you don't have clout at City Hall, you're going to have trouble with, you know, building permits, for example. You're going to have trouble with, you know, jobs in your neighborhood, post offices in your neighborhood, public transportation. Those things are changing to some extent now, but you can't, you know, no one's going to ignore the deep inequality in Jerusalem and the very real police presence in East Jerusalem. It's enough just to, you know, walk around and you'll feel it. You know, you see who's getting stopped, who's getting their ID cards checked. Yesterday we had, you know, something that was pretty close to a pogrom in the middle of Jerusalem, where Palestinian drivers were harassed and in some cases pulled out of their cars by hoodlums, by, you know, Jewish hoodlums who were kind of rampaging in part of Jerusalem. So the city is tense in many ways, and not at all, you know, happy and equal, but it's remarkably not deadly. Like the violence you're saying stops at a certain point.
Taking into account all of the factors that should lead to, you know, an eruption of violence, it still hasn't gone there yet.
I don't even know. I wouldn't even say yet because that assumes that it will go there. What I'm saying is that if you take a city like...
I'm a bit more pessimistic about...
It might. You know, that's another part of being a Jerusalemite is you think that we're always on the brink. You know what I mean? A good example was of the brink was the summer of 2014, which was this terrible war in Gaza. And the whole city was on edge. And there had been these really kind of positive and very interesting processes of... not social integration, but economic integration leading up to 2014. And there was the light rail that was running between Palestinian neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods and people moving around the city much more than they used to. And in the summer of 2014, it all stops. And people kind of withdrew into their shells. And the light rail line, which runs through Jerusalem, is in many ways the barometer of integration in the city. When the light rail is running smoothly, things are okay. When there are disruptions on the line, you know something's wrong. And there were disruptions that summer in the Palestinian neighborhoods on the northern part of that line around Shu'afat Beit Hanina. There were, the line stopped running in those neighborhoods because of riots in the neighborhoods that were
also in 2015, right after the Abu Khdeir incident. Abu Khdeir,
exactly, another example of like the breakdown of these very kind of fragile processes of integration. You can tell by looking at the light rail line, which is like a municipal indicator. But in 2014, you saw the city kind of approach the brink, and many of us were concerned that we were about to see a return to the years of suicide bombing in 2001, 2002, when the city was kind of hell. Buses were blowing up here, cafes were blowing up here. But you saw people step back. We approached the brink, but people stepped back, and within a few weeks, the light rail line was running again, and people were back at work. And that's the amazing thing, in my opinion, about Jerusalem. And I would say this about the Jewish residents of Jerusalem and the Palestinian residents of Jerusalem. People have their own views, which are often very extreme in the city, right? In the Jewish side of the city, it's hard to find, you know, nice, fuzzy Western liberals.
Yeah.
And on the Palestinian side, you know, there's a lot of support for Hamas in parts of East Jerusalem. And it's not, you know, there are very few liberals in this city. People have their own beliefs, and people have a long kind of list of accounts with the other side, which is very real. People have lost a lot in this conflict. People have suffered a lot, whether it's the loss of relatives, whether it's having your house demolished by the cops. People have, you know, a long kind of painful history. And yet in the morning, they get up and they lock that away somewhere and they go to work.
But they probably are waiting for the opportunity.
I'm not sure.
To, you know, settle the accounts.
Maybe or maybe not.
Unless, look, I guess then there are two ways to approach these moments of these periods of instability, whether 2014, 15, whatever these periods are, like 1 month of tension. If you take them separately, you can say, oh yeah, look, we're always stepping back from the brink. But if you look at it through continuity of, you know, for the past 20 years, every 16 month, we have trouble. You can say, okay, wait, there's something going, like, it's never ending. It's building up to something. Because if I had it in 2014, I had it in 2015, maybe we were skipping a few incidences that happened afterwards. We're always skipping something that is there. But because we're looking at it separately, we're like, oh, no, 2014 is different than 2015. We're missing the bigger picture that something is boiling, something is cooking, and it's going to explode one day. And only retrospectively, after it has exploded, we're going to say, ah, we should have counted it all together. Like the clock didn't start in 2014. The clock didn't start in 2012. No, this is actually an accumulation of separate incidents that put together made whatever happened happen, you know.
I think what you're saying is that the safety is the anomaly and the conflict is the, you know, the real picture. I actually, after having lived here for many years, I think it might be the other way around, that we live in a kind of with a consciousness of conflict, but our day-to-day lives, given what could happen here and given what has happened here in the past, again, 20 years ago, things are remarkably functional, not just compared to other cities of conflict, but compared to American cities where no American thinks there's a war.
But let's put look, I'm not very American-centered, let's say, or oriented, right? I've never been to America. It's on my TV. I don't even have TV. It's on my laptop or something, right? So I'm going to focus on the Middle East. Like, my standards and my comparative analysis is going to be to the Middle East, especially the past of this place, right? The reason why I'm not trying to push back. I'm just trying to counter-argue here. But I just watched a Lebanese podcast with a Lebanese historian. He's a cool hipster Lebanese historian. Young guy, you know, earring, pipe. You know, it looks very cool. Gets a lot of followers because he's presenting Lebanese history in this very sexy way. And he was saying, look, the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Christians, they all lived well together before. He was saying, like, Lebanon didn't exist until 1920. So don't listen to the myths that the ruling class is trying to sell you. We all lived together very well because we all lived in misery. You know, we went through a famine because of some trade routes that were disrupted during World War I. He just went on. And then it reminded me of this other story that I hear about here, about Jerusalem, the Levant, more or less, that Muslim Christians and Jews lived very well. You know, they were living happily together. Maybe not happily, but they got along, right? They got along. And then a political incident disrupted the fragile peace that they all had. And now we know where we're at, right? Everybody's at each other's necks, more or less. And so those two perspectives come from one theme of this romanticized view of the past that, you know, that no, we all got along well together. And my question is always, well, if you did, then why is there violence? Every 30 years, every 20 years, there is violence. Something is not working. And that's what I'm trying to tell you, is that how sure are you that you're not falling into the same romanticized view of the past, you know, but in the present, in your case, of that, no, we're getting along. But then every time somebody has said we're getting along, a violent something erupts violently and destroys that perception of that we're getting along.
First of all, as for the kind of romanticization of the past, I think that's a kind of a human weakness. And of course, it's, you know, it's bullshit in the case of Lebanon. And in the case of Jerusalem, things were awful. But
somebody could say that about you in 20 years. Well, we'll see. Matthew Friedman was on Oppo and the City at and this day.
It's being recorded. They can find the recording.
And he said that.
I'm not predicting, you know, future of peace and happiness necessarily.
That's why you're here.
I'm just pointing out, which is kind of undeniable. If you look at the statistics from the past 10 years, the city is many, many times more safe than any American city of similar size, even though we have these warring groups, even though in this city, Jews control Islam's third holiest site, even though the people who live here have a long history of pain and loss in a conflict, and even though they're forced to live with the people who've been, you know, tormenting them for generations. They live together, they work together, and yet the city somehow functions, maybe not, you know, as well as Copenhagen in 2021, but better than Indianapolis, right? And better than New Orleans, and better than cities where, you know, no one considers there to be a conflict.
And I think
that's a separate question, but I like to point it out because when you read about Jerusalem from abroad, you assume that it's a conflict zone, and then people come here and they can't figure out why it's not. And you speak to people here and they kind of have a consciousness of conflict, but the day-to-day life of the city is remarkably, say for most
civil.
Of the people who, yes, I mean, on a, even if it's just a veneer of civility, it is civil. People make an effort. Most people, not all people and not all the time, but most people are making an effort to make it work and to make sure the city doesn't fall apart again as it almost did in the early years of this century when I was a university student here. And, you know, I was studying Islamic studies at Hebrew University when Palestinians blew up the cafeteria at Hebrew University. And it was just, you know, that was just like that week. It happened all the time. So we know where the city can go. And it doesn't go there and it hasn't gone there for a while. Whether it will go back there in the future is possible. But I think that when we're trying to understand the city in the present, we have to look at it and be able to point out the positive along with the negative without seeming to be justifying injustice. I mean, I think one part of the problem is that people think that if you point out the positive trends in the city, you're justifying the real injustice that exists in the city. And I'm not justifying it. There's deep problems in the city. Anyone who lives here, of course, knows that. But we can't appreciate what's going on in the city, and we can't encourage the positive trends unless we put our finger on them. And if you can put your finger on what works in Jerusalem, then we can encourage that to keep working. And if you say that nothing works in Jerusalem, there's no hope, because then what are we supposed to nurture in the city? And you know that as someone who works for, you know, this place, which is an example of very smart people who put their finger on something.
We're talking about
Filbet, which is part of this really interesting, I mean, if you're a listener of the podcast, I assume you know, but it's a very interesting attempt to kind of harness the culture and energy that exists in the basement of Jerusalem and use it to kind of move the city in the right direction. And that's possible. But in order to do that, you have to be able to admit that there is positive energy here that can be used for, you know, for beneficial purposes.
Well, then that brings us to the Israeli elections, the upcoming Israeli elections. Is that going to snuff out the energy, the positive energy, or is that not going to? Are you following the elections?
Saying the upcoming Israeli elections is just something you can say at any time.
Yeah, right? In 2 weeks, there's going to be another election, and then probably another.
We're heading into our fourth election in the space of 2 years, which is a pretty, you know, catastrophic.
But I'm pretty sure you're following it as a journalist. No,
I'm following it as little as possible.
Oh, really? Have you given up?
Well, my thrust as a journalist has never been national politics. It's always been the street and the people and the society. That's always been much more interesting to me than national politics. A lot of journalists just are drawn by their nature to what the prime minister says. I don't care that much. I think that what makes Israel interesting and what makes Jerusalem interesting is not, you know, the mayor or the prime minister. It's the people who live here and how they interact and who they are. So, but I am following it, of course, and, you know, getting depressed by it whenever I...
Do you think, I don't know what the results, I mean, I don't know how you think it's going to end, who's going to win and how much they're going to win, but in your calculations, in your estimations, does Jerusalem pay the price? Because Jerusalem is ultimately the city that pays the price for any elections, right?
In some ways, we're affected, of course, by the broader national trends, right? We have this war in Gaza. Gaza's not in Jerusalem, but Jerusalem is affected because people are invested in the war and people's emotions kind of flare. And so, you know, of course, if there's a war in Lebanon, you know, even though no one from Jerusalem would necessarily be involved, we're going to feel it. We're going to feel it here because that's the kind of city this is. On the other hand, Jerusalem in some ways is its own story that isn't necessarily affected by this by trends in the way that you would think. So we have, you know, looking at the past 10 years, the right wing has been running Israel, right? Netanyahu, the Likud. And in some ways, the trends in Jerusalem in that time have been more positive than they were in the previous decade.
In what sense?
The city's been safer. You know, when we had labor in power in the mid-90s, you know, and late 90s, that's when the city exploded into this horrific violence that, you know, took us years to recover from. With the right in power, in a strange kind of contradictory way, more investment ends up going to East Jerusalem because the left always believed that the city was going to be divided and that the eastern part of the city was eventually going to be ruled by the Palestinian Authority. So why invest in it? These people are under our control temporarily. So we're just going to kind of let them sit, and eventually the city is going to be divided and they're not going to be our problem. The motivations for that were positive in most cases, but it ended up meaning neglect. The right believes that the city has to be unified under Israeli control forever. And that requires them to, at least to some extent, put their money where their mouth is and make East Jerusalem part of the municipal, you know, body that we call Jerusalem. So we've seen, you know, pretty dramatic increase in investment in East Jerusalem, which is only beginning to be felt on the ground. But we're talking about hundreds of millions of shekels that have gone to developing East Jerusalem. Again, this is coming from the right because the right's own, you know, peculiar view of or particular view of where Jerusalem is headed. And that's part of the glue that sticks the city together when you would expect it to fall apart. The glue, what pulls the city apart is very easy to see. What sticks it together is much harder to see. And what sticks it together, things like healthcare, public transportation, social welfare, jobs in the Talpiot industrial zone, things that are hard to put your finger on. And if you're a foreign journalist covering this place, you never notice them because you're only talking to, you know, political leaders who will never admit that any of this is going on. Sure. Why does the city not fall apart when it should? Because there's a secret glue that holds it together. And the Israeli right is doing its best to strengthen that glue in order to make sure that the city can't be divided. So in a strange way, the Israelis...
So in a strange way, for the sake of Jerusalem's, I don't know, sustainability maybe, or maintenance, it's in the interest of the city that a right-wing government rules again.
That is a...
I'm just saying.
It's a tricky... Well, you've just been recorded saying that, Apo, and we can now take that quote and, pull it out of context.
But it's according to what you just said.
No,
because look, there is some truth to what you're saying. I'm not denying it.
It's a contradiction for someone like me who's always been on
the... Although, I would say that, sure, now there's going to be, I don't know, like a $300 million investment in Wadi Jouz, right, in the neighborhood. They're going to turn it to a Silicon Valley of its sort.
Silicon Wadi.
Yeah, Silicon Wadi. You're right. I have a few friends that live in Wadi Jouz. They're a bit suspicious about it because, although, I mean, it's funny because I also have some people at the municipality that, showcased me this, we're building, Silicon Wadi. There are going to be high-rise apartments and all that. And the first thing that a Palestinian is going to ask, who's going to live in those high apartments?
Who are the apartments for?
Who are the apartments for? Are they for me? Or are they for, Jewish settlers that you're going to bring to live here? I mean, that's the other question, is that, sure, you're right. It's probably going to look prettier. There's probably going to be a lot more money spent in these areas. But
who's it going to serve?
Who's it going to serve?
And I think that's a great question. If you're a Palestinian resident of Jerusalem, that is the contradiction in the fact that the move toward the integration of the city is coming from the right. So if I'm, Palestinian and, a right-wing Israeli government comes to me and says, I want to invest in your neighborhood, I'm suspicious of that. What are your motivations? What really are your motivations? And I think the Israeli, establishment has failed in convincing the Palestinians that their intentions are good. I'm not sure that their intentions are all good necessarily. When you look at a place like Silwan, where we have this development of the neighborhood, but it's being run by religious settlers, basically for their own purposes. Their interest is not primarily the well-being of the Palestinian residents of Silwan. They have their own, movie that they're starting.
Exactly.
And then if I'm a resident, then I say, okay, I have 300 million shekels, investment. That sounds good, but what exactly is it? What is this? What's the script here? Those are all very, very good questions.
I was talking with a drunk Palestinian who's from the north. So he's from Nazareth, but he's been living in Jerusalem, I think, since the age of one. Like, his parents moved here when he was one. And he told me, he's like, look, dude, like, I know Israelis very well. I've lived with them my whole life. I think he even served the army. He said, I even did all that. And he told me, at the end of the day, they're gonna give Beit Hanina away. He told me, there's this theory that if you look at where the checkpoints are put on Yom Kippur, where the check, so you don't know this? So whenever they ask, how are you going to divide Jerusalem? If you were going to divide Jerusalem, there are some people that say, look at the map of where the Israeli police put checkpoints at the entrances of Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. Those will be the borders of a divided Jerusalem, right? Because they put the checkpoints so that, Palestinians do not drive their cars into Jewish neighborhoods on Yom Kippur. And he said, look at where all of these checkpoints are. That will be where the dividing line is going to crisscross, more or less. And he's completely, and he says, look, man, no matter how much money they put in these places, they will give it up. If they believe it will serve their interest, they will give it up. They will give up on Beit Hanina. They will give up on the Silicon Wadi. They will give it all up. And Tim was like, really, do you think so? But then because you put billions of dollars in a territory does not necessarily mean, especially a disputed territory, right? Or in this case, an occupied territory, as the international community calls it. At a certain point, you always have that, that clause, that amendment, or like that appendix that I might have to give it up, even though I'm putting all of this money.
Sure. And if you look at Sinai, Israel, had settlements in city, and a pretty substantial city in Sinai that it uprooted when that territory went back to Egypt. Gaza, Gaza had, I think, 8,000 or 9,000 Jews living in there, and had a heavy and very expensive army presence, and that's all given up when the territory goes back. So the fact that these investments are being carried out does not guarantee the internal Israeli sovereignty over the city. But what it does mean is that this glue, the kind of secret glue, is being strengthened all the time and is making a division harder, for better or worse. What it means is that the city can't function divided. And you saw that in 2014. And I think that's really what led people back from the brink, when the city was kind of deciding whether it wanted to blow up again or stick together. And people sat and thought, okay, listen, let's say I have a, you know, a garage in Talpiot. I fix cars.
Well, my dad does.
Right. But I'm not your dad. I'm, you know, a right wing, you know, Jewish guy. And I, you know, I have my own views about, you know, who should be in charge here and then the place of Arabs here. And maybe I prefer that there be absolutely no Arabs in the entire city. But all my workers are Palestinian.
Yeah.
So if the city splits and people can't get back and forth, I have no business. Or if I'm a Palestinian who lives in, you know, Damukab or something, and I support Hamas in theory or in practice. So that means I believe that there's absolutely no, you know, legitimacy to a Jewish state here, that the Jews have no right to any political power here, and that they should all go back to where they came from. But, you know, but I work at Hadassah Hospital.
Yeah.
So if I can't get across the line, I don't have a job. You know, if you look at the staff at Hadassah Hospital, it's completely mixed. The doctors are Palestinians, the doctors are... It's not, right, I'm very careful of the word peace, because peace, I think,
has all kinds of peace theory, right? Yeah, the Shimon Peres sort of dream, no?
Well, Shimon Peres, I think, thought it would... You had more kind of starry eyes, but yeah. I don't think it's peace. Like, I don't think it's peace. I just don't use that word anymore, right, because the expectations that it raises are too high, and I don't think we can deliver on them. And I'm not sure where there is peace. Is there peace in Indianapolis? I mean, Americans might say yes, but more people die there than here. So I'm not sure. What the economic glue does is it just pushes normal life forward when something threatens to pull it apart. People make that decision. They say, okay, am I going to rip the city apart, or am I going to get on the light rail and go to work? And at the end of the day, most Jerusalemites, whether they're Jews or Palestinians, get on the light rail and go to work instead of letting the city fall apart. That's all. That's not peace, but that's pretty important.
Sure. But let me scandalize it a bit. Democracy can be the tool here to break all of this apart, like to untie all of this. Because if you have politicians, we're talking about these elections, right? The upcoming elections. If you have politicians that are running on manifestos that aspire to separation, to inequality, to complete intimidation and provocation and radicalization, these guys don't give a shit about the economy or how the economy is gluing things together and keeping the fragile peace, whatever stability that we have. These people, they don't care about the pocket. To them, the messianic vision of sovereignty and of only us and not them, only the in-group and not the out-group, they're willing to set fire to the whole house. They don't care, right? And these people, because there is a democratic system, more or less, right? Let's call it the Jewish democratic system. These people can get voted on and can get into these halls of power, sit on these seats of power, and decide, fuck it, let's bring it all down, you know? In the sense, you're right about the economic glue, but it is threatened by that one thing that you would think would strengthen it, which is the democratic game. But that democratic game is the number one tool that can bring it all down.
There is some truth to that, although I think if you're looking at the radicals who would really say let's burn it all down, they exist in the system,
but they normalize the claim for it. They normalize the directive.
But if you look at the heads of the three big right wing parties right now, so that's Likud, that's Netanyahu at the head of Likud, Saar at the head of New Hope, which is basically like Likud but not corrupt, and Bennett, who's the head of what used to be the National Religious Party. Those three guys are really economic guys. You know, they're not out for messianic expansionism.
Yeah, but Bibi courts Otzma Yehudit, right? That's what it's called. Jewish power, is that what it is?
Absolutely, which is a extreme. You know, basically terrorist, you know, a movement. At the same time, he's courting the Islamist movement in Israel, headed by Mansour Abbas. So he's basically out to get votes on the fringes wherever he can. And you know, I'm not a supporter of Netanyahu, but he's not a guy who's into setting the thing on fire. On the contrary, what he's saying, and I don't necessarily agree with this, what he's saying is our tough posture, our statement that we are not pulling out, and that this is the status quo that's going to remain, that ensures stability. So people are going to know in East Jerusalem that we are not going anywhere. So if you had an expectation 20 years ago that, you know, within a few weeks the Israelis would be gone and the Palestinian Authority would be here, you have to understand that that's not true. And now we're going to put money in your side of the city and we're going to integrate you to some extent. The question is, to what extent, and what's that? What's the glass ceiling where people are going to have their integration stopped? So, okay, you can work at the supermarket, but can you be the manager of the supermarket? Okay, you can work at City Hall, but can you be the mayor? And a lot of that has to do with what Israel decides to do, and Israel's policy on Jerusalem basically doesn't exist. There's such confusion about whether we want the Palestinians in East Jerusalem to become citizens, which legally and theoretically they can, but functionally, as you know, is extremely difficult. Do we want that to happen? Like, wouldn't that make sense if we, you know, have our capital, which includes East Jerusalem?
Isn't that the loophole?
Why don't we let everyone become a citizen? Why don't we go out and give everyone passports, and that will cement, you know, Israeli rule in the city? Another part of the equation is how the Palestinians deal with their role in Jerusalem. So one of the, you know, I think, you know, mistakes that the Palestinian leadership always made in Jerusalem was not, you know, picking up the gun that the Israelis placed on the table, which is the municipal vote. After 67, everyone can vote in the municipal elections, which basically means today that Palestinians could decide who the mayor of Jerusalem would be. And sure, if they voted, you'd see a lot of Palestinian clout in City Hall and things would really change in the city. And that might mean that Israel would say, okay, we're dividing the city tomorrow because this is completely unacceptable. Or it might mean that you'd see some pretty rapid integration as the political system in Jerusalem adapts to the fact that a third of the voters here at least are Palestinian, and that their needs need to be taken into account. So the boycott of the vote, I think, has been a pretty, you know, historic error. I thought maybe that would change in the last election. There was a Palestinian candidate who kind of seemed...
There were two.
There were two, that's right. There was one who...
Aziz Abu Sara.
Who was a really interesting candidate, but he pulled out before the
end. People threw eggs at him.
Some people threw eggs at him, and other people threatened to kill him from all sides of the political spectrum in Jerusalem. But one candidate made it to the end, Ramadan Dabash. I wrote a profile of him for the New York Times, and he didn't manage to get enough Palestinians out to the vote to get in, to even get one seat on the municipal council. But I think if you had four or five candidates, you might see a different kind of...
Because he's from... but Ramadan Dabash, was it? Mm-hmm. He's from Sur Bahar.
He's from Sur Bahar, yeah.
Right? To a Jerusalemite in Beit Hanina, like to the North Jerusalemites, that's not even... They're like, where the hell is Sur Bahar? We don't even know that guy. So, if you're not walking the street, like the Salah Ad-Din Street, if people don't know you, if people don't see you on Salah Ad-Din every day, you simply do not exist in Jerusalem for them. Like, I exist much more to Palestinians in Jerusalem than Ramadan Dabash, because I know the ins and outs of the market, like the old city.
Right.
I know Salah Ad-Din Street very well. You know, when I walk there, I'm saying hi left and right, hellos left and right. He didn't. I mean, you want to win the Palestinian street, be there.
It's funny. Mm-hmm. Of course, what you're saying is true. And people looking at the city from the outside, you think Palestinians are one thing and Israelis are another thing. But of course, Palestinians are, you know, 100 different things. And the Israelis here are 100 different things. And there's Palestinians from Sur Bahar and there's Palestinians from Beit Hanina who think the people from Sur Bahar are peasants that have nothing to do with Jerusalem.
Exactly.
So it's very complicated. And that makes it harder, of course, to kind of get a lot of people behind the candidate because people are divided among themselves. I'd like to see that change.
Although when it comes to Jerusalem, to the Jerusalem elections, I would say the Palestinian vote is still, it's still an untapped vote. So it's still one vote, I mean, right? Because like the Jewish vote in the Jerusalem elections is divided between the secular, the hipsters, the Haredi, this Haredi, that Haredi. You know, it's fragmented. You're like, yeah, the Arab vote is just one big chunk of vote just waiting for you to use because it's not developed yet, you know. Once they start to vote, in 20 years or maybe less, it'll start to fragment between this camp, that camp, that camp. I've always told my Israeli friends, you have if you get to maximize the minimum of the Arab vote, you're good because it's a monolith still as like a voting ballot, whatever.
It's true, and that's why I think the Palestinians could decide who the mayor would be, because the 2/3 Jewish majority in Jerusalem is split between people who agree on very little.
But was it, that was the argument that Aziz Abu Sara made, that to be the mayor, you'd have to be a citizen. And because 30% of the city residents are not citizens, he wanted to prove the point that he could not be the mayor because he's not a citizen. He cannot be the mayor of his home city. And that was the point that he was trying to make, that there is an inherent flaw in the way the Jerusalem elections are set up. And he was probably trying to address that. Nobody really got it. People started to throw eggs. You don't want to be...
There are a lot of forces here working against constructive politics on different sides, but there is a real opportunity there that should be seized. And you know, if you have 300,000 people in the city, but 3,000 of them are voting, the power that you've been given is being wasted.
But that's my thing about like these, the radical, you're saying the deconstructive forces or like the destructive forces, right? The destructive forces that are trying to silence the constructive voices. Maybe we don't need this democratic game that's giving, you know, platforms to these discord. Maybe we need a dictator. Maybe Jerusalem. Look, again, let's not forget, we're not in Scandinavia, okay? We're not in Europe. I mean, maybe now I sound like a right winger that is always like, hey, guys, we're not in Europe and our neighbors are not Norway or France, you know? We are where we are. We are where we, and we know where we are. This is the land of blood and sweat, you know? And if we're giving free platforms to voices that are complete, that are determined to destroy everything that we have, or the little that we have, let's not even say that everything that we have, why don't we just say, hey, you know what? Let's stop for 30 years, this free assembly and all that. Let's bring a strong man or a woman, you know, make sure we probably prop up the education system and make sure we get wiser generations and wiser kids that will not do the mistakes that we're doing, that will not give the right of free assembly to people that want to annihilate that free assembly right, you know? I don't know. These are questions that, you know, because my Palestinian friends, they always do say that, you know, when the Arab Spring started in Egypt, a Bejeli friend of mine was like, I don't get it. He's like, I don't get why the Egyptians are doing what they're doing. They're like, dude, you have work, you have life, you have stability. Man, you have freedom of movement, right? For a Palestinian, that's very important. You have, not that you have freedom of movement between going one country to the other. No, from village to village, you have freedom of movement, which they don't in the West Bank, right? They're like, so what if you have a dictator that's doing his job? Let him do his job. I know now I sound like a provocateur saying this, but if in Jerusalem we're still not figuring it out and people are paying the price, and our kids will pay the price one day, right? Because the longer we don't solve this or find a way out, our kids will pay the price. Your kids will join the army. Palestinian kids will probably be at the receiving end of those bullets and all that. I mean, if everyone's paying the price more or less. But we're saying, you know what? No. Let's still experiment in this democratic game of everybody has free right, everybody's free speech, free assembly, free this, free that. And then these radicals are coming. And then what? And because it's a democracy, right? Especially in Israel, you have to court the radicals to not lose votes. Thus, you give them a mainstream. Not only do you give them, you normalize their radicalism. To the point that your kids are probably going to say, hey, you know what? He's actually right. Yeah, he's actually right. Arabs are animals. He's actually right, you know? And that doesn't help. I don't know, man. It's just, we need to know. What did they do in Singapore? What did the leader of Singapore do? Didn't he snuff out all freedom of speech? And now he's built a Jerusalem. So what is the population of Singapore, more or less, right? Maybe a million? He's built a Jerusalem. A very diverse community, right? Because in Singapore, you got the Chinese, the Indians, the Malaysians, and all that, right? Yet they get along, right? It's a dictatorship, but they're getting along because of the economic glue that keeps it all together. But they got one dictator that told them, look, we're going to do this right. No more radicals, no more this, no more that, okay? We're going to focus on the economy. If you come, and if for one moment, you say that other group deserve less or you deserve more, we're taking you out. You don't fit. And look what happened to Singapore. Everybody wants to work with Singapore nowadays. I don't know, man.
Today Apo started his race to become dictator, the first Armenian dictator of a country other than Armenia. But I think that that was a very Middle Eastern statement, which, and I think a lot of people agree, by the way, not just in the Arab world, but but among Israelis too. Not that we need a dictator, but that there's a suspicion of what freedom could lead to, or what a power vacuum could lead to. And I think that actually does have a link to the Jerusalem story, which was that in the 1990s, which is when I came here, I moved to Israel in 1995, and it was very much the years of the Oslo peace process. And the Western assumption in the 90s was that if you create a power vacuum, something better will happen. So, you know, the Soviet Union's, you know, terrible totalitarian regime falls apart and it becomes democratic. That's what we understood was happening in the 1990s. There's a peace process here, which seemed to be moving things in the right direction. The idea was that if you knock out Saddam Hussein in Iraq, there's going to be a power vacuum in Iraq that's going to become a democracy. This turns out not to be true. If you create a power vacuum in the world, it doesn't necessarily become a democracy. In fact, at least in the Middle East, it's much more likely to become chaotic mess that's going to make everyone miss having a dictator. And that happens in Iraq, where, you know, more than 300,000 Iraqis die as a result of the chaos unleashed by the American invasion. It happens in Libya. Gaddafi is, you know, punched out of the box. Libya is supposed to become a democracy. There is no Libya. It's just chaos. Yeah. You know, Yemen, it almost happens in Egypt. It's Syria, right? Assad loses his grip. 500,000 Syrians get killed. So there's a real, you know, fear that a power vacuum could end up being so terrible that we're all going to regret, you know, creating one. So if the idea in the 90s was that we would just create a power vacuum in the West Bank, Israel would pull out of the West Bank, pull out of East Jerusalem, and something better would happen there, because that's the nature of mankind. You know, we're all moving toward progress. The arc of history bends toward justice. And if you let people run their own affairs, you're going to get something that's going to resemble a democracy, or at least stability. And we know that's not true. Right. Israel pulls out of parts of the West Bank in the 90s, and we got the worst wave of terrorism that we'd ever seen, which, you know, we mentioned before. So there's a real fear on the Israeli side, which is explicit, and on the Palestinian side, I think implicitly. What could happen if a power vacuum is created? What happens if the occupation does end? What happens if the Israeli military pulls out of the West Bank and East Jerusalem? Who takes over? And that fear that, you know, what that could mean, which you express, I think, in part, anarchy, that fear that you expressed in your campaign to be dictator, and the fear that I feel very, you know, having lived through the years of suicide bombing here, that's a real fear, and these kind of blithe Western assumptions that if you just pull out, things are going to be okay. No, human societies are extremely volatile and dangerous, and someone has to be in charge, preferably liberal Democrats.
But my rant was against the liberal Democrats. That, I mean, it's not really a rant against them, but the point was, even in a liberal democracy where you think by giving free speech, people will vent out and that's it. You're like, no, these people are not venting out, because these people, just like you said, these people are believing in the Jerusalem of the clouds, right? It's a heavenly Jerusalem that they're willing to scorch the earthly Jerusalem for. And who pays the price? We do, right? The people that are trying to build the earthly Jerusalem, because as far as I've read the Bible, it's what you should take care of this earth, and then God will hopefully judge you well in the next world, right? But these people don't care about that. And because of liberal democracy and all that, the radicals, the ones that want to scorch this earthly Jerusalem, get platforms, and then they get votes, and then they destroy lives, they destroy cities, they destroy societies and communities. But we're supposed to say, all right, you know, this is the democratic game. They get to incite the fire and keep on inciting it for years and generations and centuries. But we're supposed to be the Democrats here and say, sure.
Well, you know,
it's their right.
They say that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others.
Yeah, didn't Churchill say that?
Who knows? But let's say it was Churchill.
But that's not even a good standard. You know, that's, you know what kind of standard that is? That's like me saying, hey, man, Armenia is not as bad as Afghanistan. You're like, sure, but like, it's not as good as Sweden. What the hell was that standard? You know, why compare yourself to the worse if you can compare yourself to the better? I don't know if there is a better system of democracy, or maybe technocracy is better, but there is no accountability in technocracy, so I don't know about that. But I don't know. These are just, I'm trying to save Jerusalem from a total damnation. I feel like it's coming sooner or later.
Well, that's a very Jerusalem thing to say.
That it's going to come? I don't know, man.
Like, the prophets have been saying it for 3,000 years. It's all over the Bible.
Hey, didn't a flood a few times around here or an earthquake? Didn't like an earthquake or two wipe out Jerusalem a few times? Yeah. If you go to the old city, the market, before you get to the Himmel shop of Arafat, okay, there is like ruins and columns. And they say that was done through an earthquake.
Sure, there was an earthquake here a century ago.
Yeah, right.
And apparently on average, there's an earthquake every century.
So it's coming.
You can chew on that.
It's coming. I better get my bunker ready and my, what do you think? I'm going to get my team ready. There's going to be anarchy here. But Matty, you and I will save Jerusalem. You know how to shoot. You've served in the army, right?
My hunch is the Armenians are going to be the last ones standing.
Dude, there's like 20 of us left. Of course, we're going to be left standing. But I think I'm going to be in Armenia when that happens. I don't know. I'm not that I'm giving up on Jerusalem, but I feel like for the next 10 years, I want to focus on another place in my life. You know, I said, let's leave the Middle East, the war-torn Middle East, and let's go to the war-torn Caucasus.
Just for a change of scene.
Just for a change
you
of scene.
You wouldn't want to go to somewhere that isn't war-torn because that might
exactly.
just be too confusing
but
for you.
But when I do die, and if I get to heaven, I'm going to tell God, yo, I deserve another round at life. And I'm going to tell him, you cannot make me an Armenian from Jerusalem. You know how many war fronts that is? I want to come back as a Swiss. Come on, give me another round. Let me be a Swiss. Let me live a peaceful life.
Die of boredom.
Yeah, let me die of boredom, you know? Anyways, Matty, it was great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having
me. I hope you enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it? Do you think we, you know, fixed
Very
Jerusalem
much,
up a bit?
I think we solved all the problems, and I can't wait to see huge pictures of Dictator for Life, Apo, up all over the old city.
The funny thing is, my name is Apo, and half of the city cannot even pronounce it right. I have to probably change my name.
At one third of the city can pronounce it.
Cheers, people. See you next time.